This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. William Langston's new book, The Case of the Frozen Addicts, is a medical mystery. It includes an unlikely meeting of dissimilar characters and some highly implausible coincidences, but I can't criticize the story since it's all true. Dr. Langston is a neurologist in Northern California. In 1982, he was called in to help diagnose a mysterious disorder. Several young people had turned up in the emergency rooms of area hospitals. They were alive and conscious, but their bodies were frozen like statues. In his book, Dr. Langston tells of how he figured out what was wrong with the patients, the treatments he used, and how these events led to a breakthrough in the treatment of Parkinson's disease, a neurological disorder which interferes with voluntary movement, causes twitches and spasms, and can eventually leave a person prisoner in their own body. As Dr. Langston worked to solve the mystery, he discovered one common thread. All of the patients had recently used heroin.
Well, it turned out that back in 1982, a clandestine chemist here in the San Francisco Bay Area was trying to make what was being called synthetic heroin, which was part of what we called the designer drug phenomenon here in California. These young, bright chemists were able to make their own drugs, tailoring them to individual needs, literally. Unfortunately, however, this one chemist made a bad batch, and instead of making what was called China White, it was a synthetic heroin, made probably the most selective brain toxin that's ever been discovered to date. And when that happened and this stuff hit the streets, we started seeing young drug addicts literally freezing up overnight, like walking zombies. In fact, the addicts themselves have a name for it. They call it the walking death. But these young people couldn't move, couldn't talk. Many of them could still walk, oddly, but were frozen, literally prisoners in their own bodies. And these patients started showing up in emergency rooms here in the Bay Area.
How did you enter the picture?
Well, I was called out of a busy clinic one morning by my fellow, someone who was training under me, literally desperate for me to see this case, the likes of which he'd never seen before. And I must say I was a little annoyed at first, but finally went over to see this patient. And when I walked into the examining room, it stopped me in my tracks. Here was an individual sitting literally motionless like a statue. You could pick up his arm, put it in a position, and it would just stay there for up to 15 to 20 minutes at a time. Looked for all the world like what we call catatonic schizophrenia. But it turned out there were some telltale signs to me as a neurologist clearly pointed out to some type of brain damage. So we knew we had a first-class medical mystery on our hands, but what it was, of course, we didn't know. And this patient, since he couldn't talk, most people thought he was mentally out of it. But one of the real stunners came when a medical student on the third day was in the hospital, held up a piece of paper against his hand, and to everybody's amazement, this man wrote, "I don't know why or what is happening to me. I only know I can't move normally. I know what I want to do, but I just can't do it." He was totally normal inside this frozen body. And it took us about a half day to take a history from him, answering questions, and he would write mostly yes or no, but turned out the key word in this lengthy, multi-paged history was the word heroin. And with time, we discovered other young people who had had a similar fate. And the only common link between these patients in different hospitals in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, was the use of heroin. And that's what really led us to the cause.
It's amazing that this man who you're mentioning could write, although he couldn't move or speak.
Yeah, we were literally stunned. There's an old adage, it's one of the first things you're taught in medical school, and that is to never talk at the bedside. You never know, even if a patient looks comatose, you never know what they can hear. And in fact, this man inside was completely normal, had heard everything that happened to him. One of the most amazing stories, really, is he was in the emergency room, and often when doctors can't figure out what's going on, and sometimes it's assumed the patient might be faking it, they will administer painful stimuli to try to snap them out of it. And they had done that with this patient, and he, of course, was livid inside, and when in pain, actually tried to hit one of the doctors, but he moved so slowly, nobody in the emergency room even noticed he was taking a swing.
This is like if Edgar Allan Poe was writing about neurological disorders.
Yeah, it sure is.
So what were the telltale signs to you as a neurologist that this was a neurological disorder?
Well, it's an obscure sign, but I had seen catatonic schizophrenics before, which is it's a typical thing when you don't know what a patient has. So often people get labeled as psychiatric, and that's what had happened with a number of these addicts. But with Parkinson's disease, when you move a joint back and forth, say the wrist or the elbow, you not only encounter resistance, which you see in catatonic schizophrenia, but you get a little ratchety feel. The joint lets loose in little jumps, just like the ratchet on a wrench. And that's a classic finding in Parkinson's disease, and that told me that this was not catatonic schizophrenia. You don't see that in catatonics, so that's what really turned my opinion around on the case.
So you saw some connections between the condition of the addicts and Parkinson's disease.
Yes, although it was discombobulating. These young people looked for all the world as if they had advanced severe Parkinson's disease. But that just didn't fit. Parkinson's disease takes years to evolve. This had come on literally overnight. And these people were young, whereas Parkinson's typically hits the elderly. So we were greatly puzzled, but in really desperation, began to administer a drug called L-DOPA to these young people, not so much because we thought they had Parkinson's, but because they were dying, and this was a life-saving measure. And the results were stunning. Several of these people who had been totally frozen literally overnight recovered almost completely. One patient I remember within 3 days was normal again as this Parkinson's melted away to the point that I thought his whatever had caused his problem had disappeared, and we stopped the drug only to see him freeze up again. For anyone who saw the movie The Awakenings, which is another form of Parkinsonism, that exact experience was recounted in that movie.
But while those patients unfroze, it must have been remarkable to get the story of what it felt like when they were frozen.
It was remarkable and chilling, really, to hear what it's like to be locked inside your body, watching life go by, and not being able to tell anybody what was happening. Our first patient's girlfriend, we kept hearing, was frozen, and it took us 2 weeks to cajole the family to bring her in. It turned out they were afraid because of her heroin use. They were afraid of the law. But when she arrived, she looked like a mannequin in a department store. No blinking, no facial expression, no spontaneous movements. And it turned out the family had actually would get her up in the morning, bathe her, feed her, dress her, put her in a chair, and in the evening they would reverse that process and put her back to bed. I don't know how long that would have gone on if we hadn't been able to get them to bring her in.
So you administered the drug L-DOPA, which is used for people with Parkinson's disease?
Yes, that's right.
And that got them out of that frozen state. But then there were side effects that set in, serious side effects.
Yes, in fact, in some cases, terrifying side effects. Again, for anyone who saw Awakenings, this was very well portrayed by Robert De Niro in that movie. With time, in regular Parkinson's disease, one starts seeing these side effects. The most problematic ones include excessive movement, too much movement, jumpy, twisty, turny movements, hallucinations, confusion. That's one of the most difficult. These things all slow down one's ability to treat the disease. And in fact, sometimes eventually you have to stop these drugs at a time when they're most needed. So that's what we saw in these patients. Only instead of taking years to evolve, we began seeing these side effects within days to weeks in several of the patients. I remember one young woman, in fact, this was her first experience with drugs, Connie. She began getting terrifying hallucinations of doctors chasing her and trying to stab her and kill her and kill her son, to the point that we finally had to stop the drug altogether.
And did she return to the frozen state?
Completely.
What a terrible choice. I mean, there's no good choice in a situation like that.
It's lose-lose. But we just had nowhere to go. I think these hallucinations must have been something like Dante's hell. But again, what's worse? I mean, to be sitting there locked inside. She watched her young 4-year-old son grow up during those years, unable to even hug him or put him on her lap or anything. Very sad.
Eventually, you hooked up with a team of Swedish doctors who were doing research on fetal tissue transplants. What made you think that that might be helpful for your patients who are frozen?
Well, they had developed all of these terrible and disabling side effects of L-DOPA therapy and were really no longer having any type of meaningful life. Connie, this young woman who was the most severely affected, I was quite concerned was going to die. Because they were having all these side effects, there was really no future with drug therapy. And I had been hearing about some very cutting-edge research that was being done in Sweden, transplanting fetal tissue into the adult human brain to try to treat neurodegenerative disease, particularly Parkinson's. One of the many ironies of this story was that what really sprung that research was I was on a speaking engagement in Brussels when we're going out to a summer palace to meet with the hostess of this symposium. The bus we were on got lost and eventually stuck in a cow pasture, and we were sitting there in the pounding rain for 2 hours with nothing to do while we were rescued, and I happened to be sitting next to, in the dark, the head of the Swedish transplant team, a Dr. Anders Borkland. And the more we talked, the more it became obvious that these patients, these young people, were perfect candidates for this procedure. They did not have a progressive disease. They were otherwise young and healthy. They had their whole lives ahead of them. And if there was anything left that could offer them hope, it seemed to be this fetal transplant procedure. And out of that was born a scientific collaboration.
Would you explain for us why fetal tissue transplants of brain fetal tissue, can be effective for people with Parkinson's?
Well, let me start at the beginning. When we're born, we are born with all of our brain cells, our full component. We never make another brain cell, so you're stuck with what you've got when you're born. So if you lose brain cells when you get older for any reason, you can never make another one. This puts some real severe limitations on our brains and, of course, probably accounts for these diseases that they tend to get. So the only theoretical hope for a cure would be to replace those cells. And the first attempt to do that was the use of taking fetal tissue that started in rats, really, taking that tissue out and transplanting it into rats that had lesions in their brain to see if they could return memory or movement to the animals. And, in fact, it worked. These cells grow in the adult brain. They thrive. They make the chemicals that are necessary for the brain to function normally. And even more extraordinarily, these cells, these strangers, hook up and synapse and begin to talk to communicate with the surrounding normal brain. And that was the beginning of this whole approach to trying to treat diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's with fetal tissue.
My guest is neurologist Dr. William Langston. His new book is called The Case of the Frozen Addicts. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Neurologist Dr. William Langston is my guest. So you wanted to try fetal tissue transplants and see if that would work on the addicts that you were dealing with who were frozen as a result of that designer drug that they'd used. What were the results?
Well, the results have been, and I want to temper my enthusiasm here because medicine's so full of false hopes, pretty remarkable. One of the patients turned out she was a 95% Cree Chippewa Indian, which we didn't know, and was so disabled she'd returned to the reservation in Montana where her family lived for total care. She has gotten to the point now, she's now about 4 years out from transplantation, that she is living independently. The chiefs of the village recently gave her her own home. She actually returned to school, to a junior college, to try to get her high school equivalency and actually wants to do drug abuse counseling. I would say a very fitting thing for her to do. So it's given her her life back. It's pretty dramatic. Connie, the young woman that was most severely affected, who hadn't had any movement at all for probably 5 years, is now riding an exercise bicycle, can get from room to room, is talking. It's been pretty miraculous. She's still very disabled. I wouldn't say we've got a cure, but if you look where she started, it's very impressive. And I have to say that once she got to where she could talk, I did ask her what was it like being trapped in there all those years and watching everything go by. And her comments, really just two words, lonely and depressed, which personally I don't know how she kept her sanity. But she is coming back, and it's really been something to see.
So you had to take these addicts who were frozen to Sweden because the fetal tissue transplants would have been illegal in the States.
Well, research was really on a hold in this country. That's not why I really started. It was because they were the leaders in the field and no one else was doing it when we first started. But in the middle of all this, President Reagan chose to impose a ban on the use of all fetal cells, human fetal cells, for any type of research. And that had an absolutely chilling effect on research in this country, stopped it cold, really. So there wasn't much going on. There really wasn't much opportunity to do anything in the United States. President Bush chose to continue that ban. I must say, though, that Bill Clinton, I think it was his second day in office, lifted that ban. And as a result of that, there's quite a bit of research being done again in this area. We now hear with the new Republican Congress that there are all types of rumblings of reimposing the ban again. And I have to say that would have far-reaching consequences. Many don't realize it, but this type of research is being used for a number of other diseases: Huntington's chorea, ALS, motor neuron disease, stroke, and even diseases such as childhood leukemia. So it's not just one disease we're talking about.
How did the Swedish deal with the ethical questions surrounding fetal tissue research?
Their approach is a wonderful study, I think, in thoughtfulness in how one should deal with something like this. They first went to the Swedish Medical Ethics Committee, and then they went to the Swedish Parliament, which has an ethics committee. And all of this was done before they ever did one experiment in humans. Their guidelines, I think, everybody has adopted since, and they are crucial. I think this type of research must have extremely tight guidelines, and the critical ones are, first, that there can be no money exchange whatsoever. Obviously, that could have horrible implications, black markets and so forth and so on.
In other words, you can't sell the tissue of somebody's fetus.
Can't sell it. Should absolutely be illegal. Certainly, ethically, it's totally unacceptable. Secondly, and interestingly turning out to be almost as important, is that there has to be complete anonymity between donor and recipient. And I'm now aware personally of a case where a woman was seriously considering conceiving to get fetal tissue to treat her husband's Parkinson's, something we never would have done, of course, but that type of thing has to be absolutely avoided. And if you make it a very strict requirement that there has to be complete anonymity between donor and recipient, you get rid of that problem.
Now, in Sweden, does a woman who's having an abortion have to give permission
for the fetus
to be used in medical research?
She does. She is not told whether that tissue will actually be used or not, but she is asked to give permission. You get into another very interesting ethical argument there, because I've heard some people argue that any woman who's chosen to have an abortion has given up all rights to that fetus, has abandoned her responsibility, if you will. But I think all medical groups I know of working in this area feel very strongly that a woman would have to give informed consent for that to be used.
So what is the status now of fetal tissue experiments in Sweden?
Well, the Swedes are very slow and very methodical. They continue to do this work. They now have one patient who is, I believe, approaching 3 years off of all medications and still quite functional. They've done about 15 to 20 patients. That's something that's approaching, I don't want to use the word cure, but something close to that. But they only have one. There are major technical problems with fetal cell tissue work. We don't get very high survival when this is done. Only about 10% of the cells survive, and that may be why most of the responses are partial. I think in the long run, it's not going to be the answer. I think in the long run, just because of supply issues. If this morning after pill ever comes out, that's going to be the end of it anyway. We're going to have to find alternates, and there are many new directions afoot, including the use of genetically engineered cells. There's a company here in California that has actually developed a technique to take skin cells, the patient's own skin cells, biopsy them, grow them up, teach them genetically to make dopamine. It's called genetic engineering. And then transplanting those very same born-again skin cells into the brain to replace the missing chemical, which is dopamine, in Parkinson's. This would solve all of the problems, the ethical issues, the supply issues, and the issue of rejection, rejecting tissue, because it's the patient's own skin. So we're looking at these things as we speak.
So the case of the frozen addicts, the addicts who unknowingly shot designer drugs that ruined their brains. The case of the frozen addicts enabled you to do research that's now paying off for Parkinson's disease.
Yes, it's if there is such a thing as a hope from tragedy story, this is really it. The discovery of a chemical that reproduced all of the symptoms and signs of Parkinson's literally set off a research revolution. It led to the first good animal model for the disease. It's allowed for ways to test new drugs almost instantaneously. It's led to the hypothesis that a chemical like that may be in the environment and actually be the cause of the disease. It's given us a way to study why nerve cells die in the brain under certain types of insults. So it's a rather unbelievable story when you think about it, that bad dope, sloppy chemistry, some damaged, tragic addicts would lead to this incredible resurgence of research for a major human disease.
Dr. Langston, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure.
Dr. William Langston's new book is called The Case of the Frozen Addicts. He's the president of the Parkinson's Institute in Sunnyvale, California. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.